KCPW's broadcast from the Daily Buzz of the 2016 Sundance Film Festival is brought to you in part by Cotopaxi, Gear for Good, and from Naja Pham Lockwood and David Lockwood.
This is the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. My name is John Wildman, and this is day two on location in Park City, Utah from the Sundance Film Festival. Today we're going to be talking about the art house convergence with some industry experts, as well as having Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato, the directors of Mapplethorpe, look at the pictures, and filmmakers from the Slam Dance documentary, Fursonas, as well as the new frontier film, Notes on Blindness. All of that after the news. Welcome back to the Daily Buzz on KCPW and online at kcpw.org. We are on the ground here at Park City, Utah for 10 days here at the Sundance Film Festival, the 2016 edition. And we're going to start off with what we love to begin our shows with a Hot Topic segment. And with us, we have the guests. We have Ira Deutschman, who, of course, from Cinecom and Fine Line Features. But now I can't think of Ira without thinking Columbia University, because it's just... Every time I see him now, I just think Columbia University with Ira. We have Gary Meyer, of course, from the Telluride Film Festival and the Balboa Theater in San Francisco. Holly Herrick from the Austin Film Society. Tim League from Alamo Drafthouse. And we've got Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com. Now, we've got a lot to talk about. In fact, we've expanded this segment because we've got a lot to talk about with you guys. But let's start off with Art House Convergence, because we've got a number of you that participated in Art House Convergence. And I'd love for you guys to jump in and talk about this year's edition of that and what really were the trends.
I guess I've been elected to start here.
Ira will start off.
In terms of listening to what was on people's minds this year, the two hot topics, one of them was the fact that with Netflix and Amazon and other streaming media services making feature films, there was this issue of whether those films were going to be available in any sense for theatrical viewing. And there were a lot of very pissed off people about Netflix in particular not allowing the films to be actually shown in theaters, in spite of the fact that the theaters actually did want to see them. So I'd say that was one of the hot topics that people were talking about. And the other one, which continues, is the Oscars and diversity. Diversity's been very much on the minds of the art house folks for a long, long time in their own ways, you know, trying to figure out how to get more diverse audiences, more diverse people running these theaters. And so it sort of led into this whole thing with the Academy. It was a lot of interesting debate going on.
Well, now I'm told Cheryl Boone Isaacs was supposed to appear at Art House Convergence, and then didn't at the last minute. Someone else was sent, in her stead. Which you go, you know, could be scheduling, could be, you know, let's, you know, we're not ready really to talk about a lot of stuff, or you know, let's talk about what was being debated there as far as this, from the standpoint of people that are running art houses.
Well, you. Cheryl really found herself in the midst of a very bad timing, because all of a sudden, all the stuff was going on, and they made some decisions about changes that they're going to be in membership there.
Right.
She has actually been working towards diversity since she's been president of the Academy, very aggressively doing so, because we're talking really about the state of the industry, not so much the Academy and those kind of decisions.
Well, that's one of the debates is right. That, you know, this is not just about the Academy. This is all over.
Yeah, it's not about the Academy.
Yeah.
Because the people who come up on the stage to be presenters are pretty diverse. It's just the nominees. As far as it goes with, as I was saying, with our constituency, we have very few people of color running specialized theaters. And it's how to get more of them involved in it. Many, many of the exhibitors and film festivals reach out to people in the community to help with programming, to help with promotion. But, you know, with art houses, it's not a place that a lot of people of color are used to going to see films, and they often don't even know those theaters exist. And it's a difficult thing. When I was running the Balboa, I'm right in the middle of the largest Chinese population in San Francisco, And I would show Chinese films, and I could just not get them there. The young people wanted to go downtown to the big megaplex, and the older people preferred to stay in their homes. Just sort of the way that it was. And the same with Indian films. I tried that, and it just was very tough in San Francisco.
Well, you know, and you also bring up something that, which aside from diversity, I've been, kind of curious about the difference between our audiences, how they skew age-wise, and the discussion as far as, is it really just, frankly, older people that are actually going to the theater, and younger people more and more are simply, watching stuff online. What are we talking about as far as that, Tim?
I don't agree with that statement. I think what was interesting to me at Art House Convergence is two things. One is that particular topic of making sure that we're promoting and targeting youth coming out to the cinema and making that a priority. That was a huge sense I got from a lot of people that they're developing some really great programs to make the Art House this cultural center and to make ties to junior high school, college age audiences and share the joy of going to the cinema. And then the other interesting thing I found at this year's Art House Convergence was an air of very high positivity. Thinking about a couple of years ago when everybody was really stressing out about converting over to digital, we've done it. Everybody's there and they're healthy. And there was probably about 75 participants at this year's festival, at this year's Convergence, that were looking to open theaters or just open theaters and were looking for a peer group and advice. So just a lot of new people, young people opening cinemas. And I thought it was fantastic and quite hopeful.
One of the great things there is that we have this age range from like late teens to people in their 70s the veterans are helping the young people. Young people are teaching the veterans things. And it's just so exciting. And we have a thing called Art House Tales, two programs of six exhibitors each presenting what they do with slides and stories. And there's so much creativity going on to bring in a young audience. Yes, young audiences are watching films on small screens, but in some ways that's just exciting them about going out to the theater and seeing more films by maybe the filmmakers whose work they've seen that way. I think the other thing that's really interesting is that there were 51 film distributors at the Convergence. That does not include Sony Classics, the Weinstein Company, Zeitgeist, and any of the major studios' commercial sides. I think that's probably a record in the history of motion picture business that many distributors have been in existence at the same time. I'm concerned about where there are screens to play all of their films, but that shows a sign of some sort of health, I think.
But do you see that increased interest for them to participate in that way, being with that increased aspect, and Tim and I have talked about this on this show, I think, in years past, about eventizing and how you have to do that more and more. And do you think distributors are, kind of have an eye toward that for their films, and so therefore they're going, well, we have to actually, go to you guys and say, well, what are you doing and how can we help as far as putting on a show, I guess, I don't know how else to put it, to help with the exhibition of these films?
Eventizing is really working great with all the cultural stuff and bringing in new audiences. But when we started Landmark Theaters back in 1976, every single show we did was an event. Every day we changed a different double feature with filmmakers and with food tastings, whatever it was. Every day was an event. It was like a rock concert hall. People knew that was the one day that they had to go. And so there's a lot of that. What Tim does in their theaters and a lot of these other people do is have, mixed in with all their first-run movies, several things a week that approach different audiences to come to our place and experience something you're not going to get anywhere else.
Yeah. And Holly, I want you to jump in here.
Yeah, I think that something that I noticed at the Art House Convergence this year was how art houses are uniquely positioned to create engaged communities for film and film going. And what the Alamo Drafthouse and Landmark Theaters are experts at is creating these events that bring people back but also know how to interact with their community. And I do think that distributors, when they're looking to place films in the theater, it's less about that the old days where the multiplex doesn't even know who's showing up, to people who have a mailing list, to understand how to reach their audience, who their audience has that great trust in their curatorial ability and what they're going to see at the theater, and they're going to have a great experience. And we saw that more and more at the panels of art houses, talking about how their success lies in their ability to engage deeply with their community and constituents.
And it's you know, in those art house tales, I mean, I found myself being amazed at not only the optimism, as Tim was talking about, but also just the incredible ideas that some of these venues had about, you know, you can call it eventizing, but it's the way that they program. I was particularly impressed by, there was a venue from Hawaii that basically programs each month to be essentially a festival of films that are for a specific niche audience that they've identified in their area. And their programming completely changes from month to month as a result of that. And they add to the films parties and dinners and other sorts of things that go along with that particular niche audience, and they're constantly rotating it through the place. And, you know, that is eventizing of a certain sort, but it's also built into their DNA that they're programming in a very, very different way than what we're used to.
Wasn't it ironic that the other most exciting theater probably was the one in Alaska, way up in the Yukon, a 75-seat theater? This woman is... I mean, if I lived in that town, I'd be going every night just so that I could see her introduce the film. She was great with all the events that they do in this place.
Well, I heard, and also Dan Brawley from the great Kookalurras Film Festival. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, they do this that great thing where they have, everybody can expect basically like a 10 to 20 minute performance before every show. And then at the end of the fest, I guess they do like a whole, like, you know, review, including all those people.
Yeah. Yeah, he's very funny also.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing that, you know, talking about engaging young people, and there's this idea that the art house is aging, and to some extent in certain communities, I'm sure it is, but one topic of discussion was how millennials are looking for an outside-the-box experience that's around community engagement, and I think cinemas can provide that like no one else can. And looking to the history of cinema and those sort of deep titles that they're not going to find on their own via Netflix or streaming platforms, they can look at their art house to be a curator and bring those things up and have the cool factor. And I think Tim has done a great job of this, and others are catching along as well around the country.
I'd like to circle back to the conversation about diversity. Tim, specifically, I'm interested. I know you recently opened the Mission, mm-hmm. the Alamo Drafthouse at the Mission, and you played Star Wars, and you played a lot of other films as well. I'm curious as to how Star Wars was performing in your chains, and also how you are structuring your programming to meet your diverse audience.
I always get a little bit nervous and awkward talking about diversity as a white male, but I'll go ahead and try anyway. I'll tackle Star Wars easier. That's an easier question, then I'll dive into diversity. Star Wars did really well. Yeah.
Okay.
So the interesting makeup for the San Francisco Theater is that we have a 320-seat room, then we have four 40-seat rooms, then we have a 100-seat room. And so the original plan for opening was to have Star Wars open in the big room and then have this documentary about gentrification in one of the 40-seat rooms. But we ended up not being ready to open. We just opened up the big room. But that's going to be a very interesting theater to watch in terms of its programming, because we'll always have one giant movie in the big screen, and we're almost always going to have three very small movies in the 40-seat room. So we're going to bridge between populist movies like Star Wars that actually really help pay the bills, and then I think because the size of those theaters, we can support some really interesting niche programming. The Mission District is probably the most hotly contested gentrification neighborhood. It's a largely Hispanic neighborhood, and it's also where a lot of people from Google and a lot of the IT startups and big firms are living. So the rents are going through the roof. And I like to think of myself outside of this gentrification issue, because we're just reopening a theater that was there since 1914 or so. But we hired a community liaison, a Hispanic woman that's her job, is basically to make sure that the theater is a community center, that we reach out to the local organizations, we make the theater available to nonprofits and charities. We're going to start doing something we found through our polling. It was really important to have inexpensive movies for kids and families, so we're going to start that series up We're going to do a mix of, again, sort of big titles, and we're also going to do Miyazaki retrospective, and all the movies are going to be free. So just been an interesting way to engage the local community and get them excited about coming to the theater.
You know, Eric has been sitting over here very, very patient, and nobody is lacking of it, or nobody has opinions like Eric Childress does. So,
is that true?
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, to sort of, you know, to talk about what Tim sort of led off with there, it's kind of sad that in, you know, the culture that we have now in the sort of the Twitter era that we live in, that you have to sort of be afraid to talk about a subject like diversity if you're a certain color or a certain race or a certain sex. You know, it's a real shame that a topic as diverse as diversity has to be sort of streamlined into people who have lived a certain aspect. It's when we can all see that there are bigger, broader problems going on. I mean, the idea that the Academy is expanding its membership is a good thing, and it's obviously long overdue, but it also feels like a political thing where they're putting a Band-Aid on an arterial wound. You know, it's like, you know, you look at the top 200 movies at the box office last year, only 17 of them featured someone who was not white in the lead role. Okay, so mathematically, the options for people picking as something as goofy as the Oscars was limited. You know, and so when people sort of talk about that, it's, I think people are sort of looking at the wrong angle. And I'm wondering if that we're, you know, we're all here at Sundance, and, you know, we have films of various diversity here. You know, are any films here going to break out to be the next film that we're going to be talking about next year at the Oscars? I mean, look at last year, you know, until Brooklyn came along, the top grossing film from Sundance last year was Dope. And that was a film that the studio didn't even support to film critics when they were come awards time. They didn't send screeners of Dope. So, you know, whose fault is that, really? It's going to be interesting to see how this goes forward. Is the art house cinema going to be sort of a place where African-American cinema or women's cinema or Asian cinema or whatever, you know, this is not just a black and white issue. And unfortunately, that's what we're talking about now. There's diversity all over the place, and we're focusing on black and white. And if you're white and you say something, you know, you're being criticized for it.
So is there diversity here at Sundance this year?
Well, I'm looking at this table right now, and there are a lot of white guys at this table, and we have two women, you know, and so maybe I don't know what exactly progress is, but when someone asks me, you know, what's playing in the African American cinema, what's the first title I think of is Birth of a Nation, which is about a slave uprising, which is, you know, gets all the sort of the criticism when people talk about, you know, what films get nominated for Oscars and whatnot. Here we got, you know, this is going to be a hot topic when this movie premieres.
Do you think people come to Sundance looking for diverse films?
I think people come to Sundance looking for good films. I think that's, you know, I think good films trumps all. I think it doesn't matter what color the cinema is, as long as when people discover something, you know, that might, you know, white films might get discovered a lot more easily than black cinema and other types of cinema. But when people discover something really good, like, say, like a Brooklyn or, you know, or Dope or something like that, it can branch out. People, word of mouth builds, but you have to, you know, you have to get the foot in the door, and that's the problem. You know, I think, you know, we're all just looking for the best cinema we can possibly find here, and I don't care what color or what race or what sex it comes from.
I agree. Gary and Ira, I'm interested in hearing your position on this. Both of you have an incredible amount of experience working on the theater side and the exhibition side and the distribution side, and based on your history in the film festivals and also working with distributors, do you think that this is just a trend, this diversity card that's coming up? Do you think it's just something that'll fade? Or ultimately, I agree with what Eric is saying, that it is about a good story. It is about a good movie. It's not about the color of the characters.
Well, I mean, you're dealing with a business, if you will, that's always had two sides to it. You know, when you're talking about a film festival where you're going to be selling out almost all of your shows, no matter what you're showing, because people want discovery. And so film festival directors can afford to take chances on things. But the minute you get into the more commercial realm, and I mean even the art film side of the commercial realm, everybody bases their decisions on what's worked before. And so, you know, that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent. You know, you brought up Dope. I mean, Dope actually underperformed in terms of its expectations. So that makes distributors more skittish about picking up similar types of movies. On the other hand, on the Hollywood side of things, one of the greatest things that happened this year was that Universal became not only the top distributor of the major studios this year, but set a new record in terms of U.S. box office with an incredibly diverse slate of movies that included, you know, Straight Outta Compton. They had a lot of movies that were directly targeted at female audiences. The casting of Furious Seven, which was as that is America, or the world, I should say. But in any case, that the fact that those films worked as well as they did should actually get other people copying what they did. Realizing that there is an audience for these kinds of movies.
All right, as we finish up our roundtable with you guys, let's talk about the films that you, each one of you, are looking forward to seeing. We've had a full day of screenings under our belt now, but what are you guys looking ahead to now? Tim's shaking his head, so I want you to start with you, Tim.
Okay. I actually haven't seen any movies except for the one movie that I'm associated with. I was a producer on The Greasy Strangler, and we had our midnight premiere last night. That went well, so hopefully I'm going to segue into movies. I want to see the two Wiener movies, the Wiener Doc and Wiener Dog, not to necessarily pair those. I've been hearing really good things about Swiss Army Man, so I'm going to check that out as well.
All right. Ira?
I play Russian roulette at film festivals now. I mean, I basically walk into the theater and I say, what starts next? And it's great because I discover things that aren't on people's radar screens. And, there's a lot of disappointing stuff too. But I saw seven movies yesterday, and two of them were, nice little discoveries. And, so the answer is I don't know what I'm going to be seeing. I purposely did no research.
All right, give us the two titles, the happy titles for you yesterday.
Morris in America, which I liked a lot, and the Argentinian film Mi Amiga del Parque.
Okay. Yeah. Gary?
And Ira just answered it for me. This is the way I do festivals as well. I have not even looked at the program book yet. It's going to be show by show for me. I am looking for food and beverage-related films because I'm starting a film festival called Eat, Drink, Films Festival. But there's not a lot of those. Last year we had City of Gold. Yesterday I saw five films, and Sandstorm, it's an Israeli film about an Arab community, was without question the best film that of the seven I've seen, and maybe wind up being one of the best films I see here. It's really terrific.
Awesome. Holly?
I'm really excited to see Kenneth Lonergan's new movie, Manchester by the Sea, his last film, Margaret, which is absolutely brilliant, took years to make, and this one he got going a lot quicker, so I'm eager to see what that has. I think it's premiering today or tomorrow. I'm also really eager to see Kelly Reichert's new film, Certain Women. And I love this approach of discovery, because I do think at Sundance, particularly in the world cinema categories, you always find films that don't carry the same buzz as a lot of our American directors that we're so, engaged with. And you find things, just absolutely wonderful films that end up making it into the art house. And a great example this year was a Brazilian film that was about a maid that ended up getting shortlisted for the Oscars, and that was here at Sundance last year. Nobody was talking about it. It took a while for it to get seen and talked about.
And the world documentaries, which may never show up in this country again, so they're really great to stumble into.
And Eric?
Yeah, and I do a lot of planning and scheduling, making up my schedule, and then as soon as I'm done with it, I completely forget about all the movies that are on my list. I forget what they're about, I forget who's in them, I forget who directed them, which is always nice when I come and I just go in cold to certain movies. And as a programmer, a producer of the Chicago Critics Film Festival, I'm clearly just looking out for any possible thing that I can find, and I echo the support for Swiss Army Man, which is not the strangest film to come out of Sundance, as some people are trying to make the case for. That is just a ridiculous statement.
That's actually The Greasy Strangler.
Yes, exactly, or Wild. But I'm looking very much forward to a film called Life Animated, a documentary about an autistic boy who sort of rediscovers life through Disney films, and the idea of art and life converging like that is a topic I'm really interested in.
That's a great group and a diverse group of films. All right, well, again, we want to thank you guys for being here. Eric Childress, Tim League, Holly Herrick, Gary Meyer, Ira Deutschman, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back to The Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. My name is John Wildman, and we are joined right now with I think, a legendary duo as far as documentary filmmaking is concerned, Fenton Bailey and Randy Barbato. And also we have Edward Mapplethorpe, because we're going to be talking about their latest film, Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, which is a world premiere documentary here at the Sundance Film Festival. I saw the film yesterday, had a front row seat. So
sorry about that.
A lot of big Mapplethorpe pictures just right on me. And but this documentary is so much more than just, even though the title is Look at the Pictures, it's so much more than simply the pictures. And I was, one, enjoying just how thorough and how comprehensive this look at his career and Mapplethorpe as a person was. But I was also just kind of awestruck as how you guys made the choices in what you kept, how you winnowed it down, and I would love for you guys to talk about just to start off how you tackled this subject.
Well, you know, very long story short, I think we really got our sort of creative bead going when we figured out that it was about looking at the pictures, and then by extension, also how do we tell a story? Can we tell it in his own words? And finding this, all these different audio sources and on-camera sources, it was great because we felt we could tell the story of Robert Mapplethorpe in his pictures and in his words. And we used that as our sort of, we'd look to that. What would Robert do was our sort of, when we ran into something about, would we put this in? Do we put this, leave this out? Because we had a 4-hour cut for a long time.
Oh, wow.
I mean, and coincidentally, you know, the Getty and LACMA were organizing this huge joint retrospective. So that also became an opportunity for us to have a little bit of a narrative thread. But I think it was really when Edward, Robert's brother, who, by the way, if anybody listening is a fan of fine art photography, should check out Edward's work. But when he sort of agreed to come on, which took a few minutes, it really, you know, it was the final and most important component as far as we're concerned, because it gave us the heart of the film.
Without question.
And I do want to bring Edward into this because, you know, you're so open in this film and in your appearances and your interview segments in the film. And you know, and I cannot imagine some of the stuff and retracing your history and your relationship with your brother was. And I would love to hear from you, you know, your decision to become involved with it and to support the project and then agree to not just support the project but to be a part of it in that way.
Please understand that over the years, I've been involved with Robert while he was alive, and I was involved with the foundation, and I've attended a lot of openings, and I've done some press interviews, and, you know, I have my own career, and I have my own focus, and I have a book coming out in the spring, so I've been channeling my energy into that. So when I was first approached about the documentary, I had a hesitation. I was feeling that I had already contributed quite a bit to Robert and his career and his life, and it was time to start focusing on myself and putting the spotlight on myself. So I reluctantly, I guess you should say, I could say, I met with Fenton one day because I just wanted to see, you know, what angle and, you know, whether we were connecting. And as much as I was sort of hoping to leave that and not click and not sort of enjoy the experience, I did, and I came back and pondered the circumstance and realized that the film was definitely proceeding whether I was involved or not. And as the sole family member, I felt a real responsibility to be a part of this, to make sure that it was handled and directed in the manner that I feel was appropriate. And I'm very, very extremely happy to say that as difficult as a film it is to watch, it's a very honest film, and I wish I could re-script it in some respects, but it's a documentary, and Robert certainly was a complicated character, and there's no way of really sugarcoating that, but I am extremely proud of the job that they did, and I'm proud of the fact that I did get involved and that I'm at Sundance. I feel very honored.
What was it like growing up with Robert? when you were younger?
Well, that's a good question because I can't, there is real no answer to that because I was three when he left home. There's 13 years difference. I am the youngest of six children. Growing up, I knew I had a brother that was creative. I didn't see him often, but I started to realize that I had some sort of creative streak in myself as well. So whenever there was word that Robert was coming into the city, there was a little knot in my stomach. It wasn't the same as my other siblings. There was something different about him. Certainly when, you know, we're talking about this late 60s now, and when he would come home with Patty and, you know, dressed in leather and scarves and the long hair and the beads. And I was like, wow. I was like, you know, there is life outside of Floral Park, Queens. And I realized from those days, so I'm talking like when I was 9, 10 or so, that this was a man that I wanted to get to know. It certainly wasn't the reason I channeled my energy into photography and learning photography. I mean, that had started previously. My father was a hobbyist in photography, but you know, I just made it a point. When I got old enough, I made the phone calls and asked if I can come into the city and visit him. And you know, I was just this little kid brother, and I don't know whether he was that excited about it, but he said yes. And you know, so the relationship started then, but it certainly catapulted when I got out of university and started assisting him in the studio. And I did. I was right by his side on many of the photographs that you see in the film.
Fett and Randy, I'm also curious. I really enjoyed seeing, it was almost like this New York community that I'm familiar with because I've been in New York for quite some time. Fran Lebowitz and Deborah Harry and Chris Stein and the people like that that were part of this circle that I didn't quite even really know myself. I didn't really quite realize it because, yes, they were all during that same time. But it seems so much more close-knit than I was, aware of. And there's so many more people besides that I'm mentioning. How was it with the participation with people, you know, you guys going out to get people to talk about him? You know, was that, were people welcoming the opportunity to do that? Or did you have to do some convincing, like with Edward here?
Actually, for the most part, people were very eager to talk. You know, it was a very unique time in New York, and there were, and it's so different than New York is now, and there were so many incredible artists, and many of them knew one another, and I think, you know, all of them knew Robert, and I think they all had such interesting and compelling stories, and I think, for the most part, people were happy to be a part of it, and it was as if people had been sort of looking forward to it almost.
I mean, I think that time in New York is also so sort of, I feel we're just beginning to rediscover it now. Absolutely. Because I suppose in this completely digital age, this era before any kind of social media, before that connectivity, when people really did live on the same block. You know, when Mary Boone talks about the art world, it was Bond Street.
Right.
It's like extraordinary. And I think people feel a certain nostalgia for that. Randy and I were in the East Village in the 80s, and we knew of Mapplethorpe's name by legend. We didn't meet him, but it was an extraordinarily small world where people physically actually crossed paths, you know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there's a portion where Fran Lebowitz is talking about what happened with some photos that she had in her possession and laments what happened with those photos. But you get, you know, with everybody, because you get that idea, it's like, these are just friends. You're right. They're on the same block. They're hanging out with each other, so they don't value things. Like, they don't look at each other the way that we do at this point. And I think it's a very enjoyable aspect of the documentary.
Well, I love the fact also that the Mardens, who he lived next door to, you know, they were painters too, or artists too, and then they became really successful, and it pissed Robert off that their paintings were selling for millions of dollars, and his weren't. And I think that sort of. You see, what was interesting about Robert was he owned the ambition. And I feel there was a big shift in the 70s to the 80s from the artist as the sort of person starving in their garret to the bold-faced celebrity name. And I think Robert figured that out and knew that in addition to the work, you had to position the work. You had to get a name for yourself. And he's quite brilliant at that marketing, networking piece of it. And I just think that's a, you know, I guess he took a leaf out of the Warhol playbook to a degree.
Randy and Fenton, I am such a big fan of your work. You are both bookends in Sundance documentary filmmaking. You're icons. You've had so many films here. I'm curious, how do you select your next topic? Your subjects are so iconic in many different ways, and clearly it's a home run every time you guys get in front of a camera. I'm curious what that creative process is.
You know, I'd love to take credit, but they select us. Mm-hmm. Chaz Bono came to us. And Mapplethorpe, I think Robert Mapplethorpe said, get these guys to make a film about me. I do feel it does that spooky vibe.
It is weird. It's very organic, and it just happens. It in virtually every, even Tammy Faye sort of came to us, literally came to our house.
She did.
And so, strange.
Well, the title of the film is Mapplethorpe, Look at the Pictures, and you will be looking at the pictures, but you definitely will also be looking at a life that is going to be unexpected to a lot of people as far as the details that you guys show. Again, Fenton Bailey, Randy Barbato, it's awesome to have you guys here, and Edward Mapplethorpe, wonderful to meet you. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And welcome back to The Daily Buzz on KCPW and online at kcpw.org. This is John Wildman. I'm here with our producer and my co-host, Irene Cho. And right now we have the group responsible for the film Fursonas. I've been looking forward to talking about this movie. We have our director, Dominic Rodriguez, our producer, Olivia Vaughn, and Boomer, who's one of the subjects of the film. And we've got a lot to talk about with this film, but first off, congratulations are in order because you guys just announced that you were picked up by Gravitas. So yes. Nice work there, guys.
Yep. Thank you.
All right. I'm sure that is exciting and a relief.
Yes? Absolutely.
As I look from Dominic to the producer, Olivia. Let's start off, you know, Fursonas is a documentary which is... profiling some people in the furry community, but it turns into much more than that. And very much to your credit, Dominic and Olivia, you as a producer, that rather than just a basic profile doc, that you guys managed to dig in to some stuff that's obviously under the skin or under the fur of our men and women that are in the furry community. And Dominic, I would love for you to talk about kind of how, you know, was that something that maybe was intended in the beginning that you really wanted to delve into that? Or did that kind of happen organically the more that you got this footage and the more that you did interviews with the people?
I think it was really organic. I mean, it was 4 years, I mean, the whole process from start to finish. And for the first year or 2 years even, it was a different movie. I mean, it was just that profile piece. It was just wanting to get to know different personalities, and it was just kind of this plotless thing. And then sort of in the second half of production and everything, just kind of looking deeper into it and kind of seeing the whole media angle, because that's a big part of the film, the furries' relationship to the media. It just became this like unavoidable thing that was so interesting, and that ended up being where the film took its course. So it was just like, in the beginning of the movie, I was just like, wherever it goes, that's where we'll go.
Well, I have to say, you know, and as I was watching the film, I was thinking, I think they may have done their job a little bit too well, because everybody is seeming a little too normal, you know? And you know, it sounds odd to say that, but that was the emotional response that I was having initially, but then it kind of takes a turn, and people start kind of letting their guard down and going, you know, we are worried about what people are saying about us, and we're also worried about what some of us are presenting because we're worried about what some people are saying about us.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the many ironies of the film is that they do pretty well, you know, I mean, they come off pretty well, and that's the effort to make a good image for the furry community can be sometimes the thing that undoes the furry community.
Dominic and Olivia, for our listeners that don't know much about furries, can you give us a little background about this community and what inspired you to make this film?
do you want to start? And like, because you approached me about a doc, and then I can talk about furries.
Yeah.
Okay, Olivia
sure.
starts.
Okay. So basically, the process of what happened, we were students at Point Park University. We were in our last year looking to do our thesis film, and we had studied narratives pretty heavily there, and we wanted to do something different. So I approached Dom, who I'd made films with previously, and said, why don't we do a short documentary? And we had a completely different story set up, and it actually fell through. And it was a situation where we kind of had to come up with something quick. And it just so happened to be AnthroCon weekend in Pittsburgh, which usually happens around like July 4th. And Dom brought a newspaper to me when we met in a coffee shop, and he was like, what do you think about this? This is super intriguing. And why don't we just take a camera and go in and see what we find? And it was just so interesting and fascinating. And we were like, there's just so much here. So that's sort of how that story blossomed originally.
Yeah. Yeah. I want Boomer to jump in here, because, you know, you've got a few people in this documentary who are kind of act as lightning rods for everyone else. And Boomer, you are definitely one of them. And what cracked me up about you in this film is that you seem mystified that somehow that you are this lightning rod. Can you talk yeah. about how you got involved?
Well, I was kind of surprised about that, because I really didn't think that anything would happen. I thought that, well, I wouldn't be a rock star like some people said, you know, if I went on TV and I did things like that and was outward about being a dog. And I didn't think that, but I thought, well, you know, it would be cool because my friends will know me and they'll be nice about it. And they'll be happy for me, at least some of the furries I'd known. I thought it'd be nice. I didn't really follow the politics of the scene as much, so I didn't realize that there was the vibe that furries just don't go on the media. It's not allowed. Well, so I didn't know that, and so I actually went into it kind of blind, and I was really surprised and that I was socially like kind of got outcast a bit by the scene.
Right, and Dominic, I forget the guy's name who kind of acts as somewhat of like a almost like a father figure or spokesperson for the group. What?
Uncle Kage.
Uncle Kage, yes. And some of the stuff that you got, a lot of the stuff that you got from this guy talking is like documentary gold, and I'd love for you to talk about your discovery of that footage and how that was incorporated into the film.
Yeah, absolutely. Uncle Kage has been the chairman of the world's largest furry convention for at least 17 years. I don't know the exact, somebody has to check that, but at least that many. I knew about him for a long time. Lots of furries know about him. People have different opinions about him. I didn't want him to be in this documentary for a long time because of, I just wanted to get sort of more intimate and talk to people who would open up to me, and he's very much a spokesperson. So I wasn't really interested in him, but everybody kept saying, oh, you have to talk to Uncle Kage. You just have to talk to Uncle Kage. So eventually I was like, all right, well, I guess we have to talk to him. And then that sort of fell through because of stipulations with him wanting control of the film and everything like that. And so every clip of him that you see in the movie, they're just from YouTube videos that are from his panels. They're available to watch. They're all online. We didn't sneak in with a camera or anything like that. So he's very outward about just how protective he is of furries. But I think that can, I don't know, sometimes not have the effect that he wants.
Dominic, could you explain for our audience? Perhaps there's people out there that don't know what a furry is.
Right, we should
so
probably talk about that.
If you could break that down, and then again, why you were drawn to the subject for that
documentary. Sure, absolutely. So furry, in the broadest sense, is anybody that's interested in anthropomorphic animals, so animals with human characteristics. So interest in cartoons, and that blossoms into interest in costuming, and our film focuses a lot on the costuming angle. Any definition I give you, the furry community is going to be like, well, but you didn't talk about this or this, because that's sort of the whole tension of the film is how do you represent so many people that are into it for so many different reasons. And I have been a furry for like 10 years or whatever. And so people think that this movie is like, this is me telling my story. And it really isn't. It was when I started, I just wanted to kind of study it from the outside, but then gradually became more involved in it throughout production.
Well, the film is Fursonas. It's a documentary playing at the Slam Dance Film Festival. It can serve as your introduction to the furry community, but you can trust me, it is much, much, much more. I want to thank you, Dominic Rodriguez, Olivia Vaughn, and Boomer for coming here. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you
so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Well, Welcome back to the Daily Buzz on KCPW and kcpw.org. This is John Wildman, and I'm here with Kim Voyner and Irene Cho. And right now we're going to be talking to one of our New Frontier films, Notes on Blindness. We have with us the writers and directors, Pete Middleton and James Spinney, both co-writers and co-directors, on what I think is just a special film. Although it's well described in the catalog and the books and everything, even with those descriptions, I don't think anything really prepares you for the beauty of this film. And Kim and I were just like comparing notes before you guys got here, and just very, very happy that you guys would be here to talk.
We were rhapsodizing over the poetry and the beauty of your film.
Thank you so much. Totally.
So, but before we start, I would love for you guys to, from your own words, describe what the film is for people listening who have not maybe checked it out yet.
Yeah, sure. So about 5 years ago, we came across a guy called John Hull, who lost his sight in the early 1980s and recorded over the course of 3 years an audio diary, an incredible kind of incredibly personal and poetic and intimate account of his sort of adjustment to sight loss. And we met John, and we got to talking with him and started knocking around ideas for a kind of a long form piece that would sort of chart the full journey. And for John, it started out as a sort of a catharsis, keeping this diary and sort of documenting the experience of kind of loss and grief. Gradually documents how blindness for him becomes one of transformation, rebirth, and renewal. And by the end of about 1985, by the end of our film, he comes to see blindness as this kind of dark paradoxical gift around which it completely redefines his life. So it's quite a transformative journey, and we just knew that there's such potential in this material that we wanted to start exploring creative ways of doing it. But it's not really a conventional documentary, I think, as you guys can probably attest.
It's not at all, and there's an absolute irony that a film about blindness is shot so incredibly beautifully. And therefore, which is part of the intention, I think, is to show the beauty of sight retention in our mind, you know, as well as appreciation for what is out there that we can't see. It's remarkable.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a bit about your process and how you came up with the idea of taking the audio recordings and then using those to inform the film and having the lip syncing with the actors, the way the whole story wove together to make a story that was both visual and auditory, which kind of reflected both sides of the experience.
So we really began with these audio diaries that John kept across 3 years between 1983 and 1986.
And his daughter, by the way, is awesome on those recordings too.
That's right, absolutely. So as well as the diaries at this point, John was using tape recorders around the house to document his home life, Christmases, birthdays, baptisms. There were always tape recorders rolling. So as well as John's diaries that were kind of analyzing what blindness was doing to every aspect of his life, he was also just recording, you know, this family life, which became apparent that would be really exciting kind of actuality material for us to embed in the film. On top of that, we were also conducting interviews with John and Marilyn over the last 5 years. And we found the perspective of them reflecting on these events from a distance of 30 years allowed us to kind of move between the present tense of the diaries and of these home recordings to kind of a more reflective mode of them looking back on this period, because this actually, the period in which John became blind was also the start of their relationship, really. John had the final eye operation, which failed to save his sight, in the same week that their first child was born. And this was within a year of their marriage. So the story is completely embedded in their relationship and them kind of finding each other as partners and as parents. So it's kind of a deeply personal story. So we knew that we had these remarkable audio elements, but because it's such an internal journey that John goes on, it's one that's, you know, delves into his dreaming life, his memories, his kind of imaginative world, we knew that we had to find a form that would allow us to kind of to explore this kind of very sensory world, this very kind of internal journey, I suppose. But we didn't want to compromise the authenticity of this documentary audio. So we started developing this technique by which we'd preserve these original documentary elements and they'd form the soundtrack, but actors would play John and Marilyn and their family on screen, but they would lip sync along to this original material.
That had to be a challenge to get that right. I mean, yeah. having done voiceover recordings and stuff in film production, how did you get them to sync properly?
Yeah. So we had to devise kind of our own techniques, really. We couldn't really find... There are films that have done it. There's a film called The Arbor, which came out a few years ago, Cleo Bernard film. But we, rather than recording any sound on set, we had what we called a playback engineer, and we put pips before every line, and then the actors would kind of study the rhythms and the cadences of that audio and then lip-sync to it on set.
Yeah. I can see John's gears turning as a filmmaker. He's like,
yeah, no, because I had the same thought with Kim, is that the it's one thing, there's the story challenge of putting this thing together and figuring out what you're going to use and what you're not going to use, and then there's the technical challenge of actually executing this, and which is, if no less daunting, possibly more daunting than the story element. I'm also very curious as to, because you did have a wealth of recordings, to go by, how you winnowed that down to the story that you told.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we were largely guided by John, really. He's, so John's diaries were published in 1991, I think. But they're sort of a diary, so they're a little bit, there isn't a clear structure throughout them. So we met with John and Marilyn and his wife, and we spent a lot of time with them, getting really their sort of story, and I guess that informed how we approached it. So it took several years. We sort of carried an audio project around with us, and we were constantly, whenever we came across new material, we'd sort of whittle it down, and we bounced that around with script developers. But really, I think it always came back to the story that John wanted to tell, I think, and the narrative of his
life. Through line of the story seems to be his progress of accepting his blindness and how that affects his life. And I was noting as I was watching it, he's a theologian, and I was wondering how much that background influenced his trajectory down that path, because in your film, at least, it starts out that he was first concerned with the academia side of it. How am I going to keep being an academician? How will I teach? How will I research if these books aren't available for blind people? Why aren't they available? I'm going to solve that problem. And he compartmentalized all of the emotional, spiritual, psychological aspects until he dealt with that. And then as the film progresses, he starts to deal with that more. And I wondered how much of his theological background informed that in your view? And
I think it's certainly informed the way that he approached kind of combating the emotional distress of blindness. As you say, the first few years were kind of kept up with the practical challenges, how to navigate, how to cross the street, how to communicate. And tape recorders became woven into that because John was terrified by the idea that there might be libraries worth of books that would be soon inaccessible to him. So he kind of practically assembled this team of readers from across the city of Birmingham to help record books for him. So tape recorders were initially a very practical...
And he got hundreds of them quickly, absolutely. Right? Did he turn those into a library for other blind academians?
That's a good question. I'm not sure.
We
got the sense that he was kind of operating out on a bit of a limb, and I don't know how connected he was with other blind people at the time.
I know we have to wrap in a second, but I just had one quick question about John and his wife. The part that most touched me watching the film is when his wife was saying, I'm afraid that this blindness is going to pull us apart and that you're going someplace I can't go. It was during the part where they go back to visit his childhood home. And I was wondering if the 3 years of recording the project and then doing this film project, did that help bring her into his world?
Well, I think the fact that these interviews that we did with them, the contemporary interviews, were from a distance of 30 years, meant that we were able to move between what was the start of their relationship and then what had become, by that point, a very a distant past, still a very painful one, and they were incredibly generous in kind of what they refer to as reopening that wound of that period and going back there. But yeah, this idea of different worlds was a crucial one for them, because certainly for Marilyn, the loss of intimacy, the loss of being seen. The fact
in
that
a
she,
very new relationship, as you mentioned.
In a very new relationship. The fact that she didn't feel like she could necessarily share in this inward journey that John was going on, is a profound part of the film. Marilyn actually is in town, and she's going to be around.
For some of the Q&As. Some of the Q&As.
And that'll be fantastic. John very sadly passed away during the production of the film.
But audiences will get to see his wife at the Q&As at the public screenings.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, listen, Pete Middleton, James Spinney, the co-writers and co-directors of the film Notes on Blindness, thank you for coming, and congratulations on the film.
Thank you so much for having us.
And we're wrapping up day two of the Daily Buzz on KCPW and KCPW.org. This show is made possible with the support of KCPW and our sponsors, Cloud Electronics, Naja and David Lockwood, and SoundCloud, with support from Skull Candy, Cotopaxi, Pop Art Snacks, Angry Porcupine, Enki New York, Mountain Rest Hard Cider, You Offend Me, You Offend My Family, and The Market in Park City. Our producer is Irene Cho.